Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, aka Roger Ebert and Me, for search engine optimization purposes. This is a movie review podcast where we reenact the Siskel and Ebert show in a way. This is a tribute to Siskel and Ebert. It is an imitation of Siskel and Ebert. We are just two guys having a good time reviewing movies every Friday that come out theatrically as well as on streaming. This week, we have some heavy hitters like a new Transformers movie alongside a streaming release directed by Eva Longoria about the guy who invented the Flamin' Hot Cheeto. Or is it about that? We'll talk about that. It's very confusing. There's a lot of indies. There's specifically a couple. Well, I don't know if you'd call Falcon Lake an indie horror, but I did see it at the Brooklyn Horror Festival, which is hilarious to think about. Brooklyn 45, a Shudder release. That's indie horror. Oh, and we have another one, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster. So there are several examples of indie horror this week. And we've got Lynch Oz, a documentary about David Lynch. We've got Blue Jean, an indie drama that I really enjoyed. And Dolly Land. The less said about that one, the better, but we're going to talk about it. My co-host here is Mark Dusick of MarkReviewsMovies.com, reviewing movies since 2001, and they're all there. My name is Brett Arnold. I host this show, and I host the New Flesh podcast. Mark, I want to get to you right away because you have some, I would say, some cool news for this week. Ain't it cool news?
Let's not talk about them.
I don't even know what my riff was. I just wanted to say it. There it is. Was it just your review from your contemporary review of the time from when Dark Knight came out? Is that what they published?
Yeah. I mean, I've reviewed the Dark Knight late because I was on a break or when it came out. And so I wrote about it before the Dark Knight Rises came out.
Oh, interesting.
But that's beside the point.
Thought you were going to say because you also went to see it at the opening day at the Evanston Movie Theater and the power went out, which is what happened.
Oh, no. Saw it twice at the IMAX at Navy Pier when it was still open.
Wow, remember that RIP place. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sad that that shut down because that theater.
There's just none in Chicago anymore. I mean, is the one in Schaumburg still there? Woodbridge? Is that what
there's,
it was?
I think there is. There's also technically one. I'll find out when I see The Flash next week if it is a legitimate IMAX screen, but there is one a little bit further north in the city. Other than that, I don't think there is any. But yeah,
we're stepping on your amazing announcement here. Sorry.
No, it's okay. We can talk about the audio issues that were at Navy Pier that turned out not to be audio issues, but sound mixing.
Yes. Actually did go to that. It was the Dark Knight trailer or something, right? Or no, the opening scene. There was some come to IMAX event and see an early look at the Dark Knight, and I did go with my Dark Knight or with my Batman obsessed friends, and I think it ended up being the opening scene in IMAX, and we went home with like a fake Gotham newspaper. But yes, again, I can't stop derailing Mark. He has a cool announcement. It's about the National Film Registry.
Yeah, so I was approached by somebody at the Library of Congress, and they said, hey, this is what we do. And I'm like, yes, I'm aware. I'm very excited about that. I love what they do. And they said, we'd like to republish your review of The Dark Knight for just basically promotional purposes for the National Film Registry and the movie there. I'm like, yes, please. And so it is up there. If you go to the National Film Registry website at the Library of Congress, you can see my review listed in a nice little PDF file, along with a whole bunch of other essays and reviews from a bunch of other critics that I really respect and admire, which is a huge deal.
Yeah.
So it's there, and I'll be working on something else, hopefully, for them.
That's amazing. That's so funny. I'm glad to hear that. I actually, one of the many pitches I went through when cycling through this show that we're doing right now, that we're doing on our own, but I did pitch it around several places. And before I landed on Roger and Me, one of the things I pitched was just doing a podcast for the Library of Congress, being like, do you want anyone to just like go through every single movie that's in the Library of Congress and talk about it? Obviously, I don't think I even got as far as emailing them. I definitely pitched that to other entities and they were like, I don't know about that. I don't know if you know, podcasting's a tough industry right now. Spotify's
a little bit.
they're firing everybody. The people that spend millions can't even get people to listen. So it's amazing that we have as many listeners as we do. Shout out to James for being reasonable about us making fun of him for complaining about the Alien Ant Farm song. Us discussing Alien Ant Farm last week, Mark, has led to the most outreach I've ever had on any podcast I've ever done. We now have at least two anti-Alien Ant Farm people. There's a whole faction. It's growing. The faction is growing since we mentioned James and his pursuit to get the song changed. But then I got even more messages of support, Mark. I don't know if your inbox is blowing up with listener feedback, but I got a couple that said, do not relent. Do not change the song. I listen to it every week. It is nostalgic and great. And, you know, I'm not going to argue that the song doesn't suck. But have you considered that it's also pretty good and that it's catchy nonsense? And I was thinking about other movie related songs, and just be careful what you wish for, James, because the only ones I could think of were worse. A little song called Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something. Would you want to hear that every week? I don't think so. But, you know, Girls on Film by Duran Duran, arguably an upgrade. So maybe we'll do some experimenting in the near future. But for now, it's Alien Ant Farm. And, you know, maybe we'll throw it in the middle of the episode, too, or at the beginning. You never know when it's going to come up. I want to, now that I know that it's easily skippable, I'm going to make that a problem, an actual problem. Shout out to James for helping me realize that much like the Kings of Leon, we are big in London before we're big in America. Hopefully that surge is coming like it did for them. In about 6-7 years, this podcast is going to be huge and we'll have a breakthrough, and then everyone will hate us for selling out because we're so popular. All right, let's talk about Transformers Rise of the Beasts.
We're in the middle of an ongoing war. We'd love to have the big guys join the fight.
Roll out! Wow, that was corny when I said it out loud.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
You've never faced anything like this.
Oh, God. It's about to go down.
You get the gist. They're cars. They're robots. They're aliens. And I don't know if that trailer even got to it yet. There's also beast robots. So there's like a gorilla, a bird, a leopard or something that does absolutely nothing. Doesn't do anything. It's just background leopard. Mark, please explain this movie to me, because I kind of am at a loss for words about this one.
It's pretty straightforward, I think. It's kind of a prequel. It goes back to 1994, so before all the events of the previous five movies, but after Bumblebee. I think that's on the money.
It is, yeah. On the money, and it leads me to my first issue with the movie, which is it not basically Bumblebee felt like a remake of the original movie, in that it's like a person, you know, gets a car and then it ends up being a robot alien and they go on an adventure. That's what Bumblebee is. That's what the first Transformers is. And then that's what this one ends up being. A guy gets a car.
Well,
and it ends up being a robot. And
I feel like they all fall into that formula.
Well,
I
have to specify, because I haven't seen past
Bay
number two. I hated Bay number two so much at the time that I was like, I'm done with these. I don't care. And now I know there's like the Bay auteurists out there who would say that there's value in the loud, you know, the longest and loudest of them. But I still haven't caught up to them. But I have seen Bumblebee, which I found charming. And this one does not have any of that charm.
It does not. And that's the big issue, is that if this had come after the first five movies, maybe there'd be a little bit more value to it. I still think there's a little bit. I think these are better than almost all of the other Transformers mainline movies. That's not saying much. That's the problem. But coming after Bumblebee, which had a lot of heart and focused on the relationship between the robot and this, you know, teenage girl who's going through stuff, and they're both going through some loss and all this stuff, it actually had a point to make while being a fun adventure with some good visual effects. This one is just going right back to the formula where a bunch of robots are looking for some technological what's it that's going to solve the problem and get them back home to their planet so they can continue this war or whatever is going on there. And so it's just long chase and hunt for this thing. And it's not that interesting. I didn't find any of the new robots particularly, you know, engaging.
Well, that's there's not only are the like the human characters barely introduced, robot characters that are the centerpiece of the thing are just as like lazily thrown in there. I'm paraphrasing a colleague when I say this, but it feels like you're jumping six seasons into a TV show, two episodes into season six, and you've never seen an episode. And then you're just watching that. And that's what I felt like. So maybe fans of the cartoon, there's maybe more value because maybe that is what it is. It is exactly like the cartoon episode. But with that, I just didn't get any of the backstory I needed. I feel like they're just like, yeah, you've seen the rest of them, right? You get the gist. Just let's just get to it. But even the get to it, the action is flat. Like nothing, there's nothing to recommend at all, right?
I mean, some of the action, I think, kind of works. You can actually see the action, which is a big problem with the Bay movies. The Bay movies had a lot of issues of just like too many cuts or focusing on the humans running around while the robots are fighting in the background, which is what you really want to see. This one at least has, you can see the robots fighting, which is nice, but you're right. It is flat. You have what? The big battle on Ellis Island. You have this rolling down the mountain fight. Yeah. And then there's the big climax against a whole bunch of gray backdrop. There's the gray of like this desert in Peru.
Speaking
and then
of gray, the villains are just the Decepticons again, even though they're not. Like they're the Terrorcons, but by visual effect, they just look the same as the bad guys did in the other ones, but they're just grayer and darker. There's nothing visually distinct about this one. And like, the best thing I could say about it is that, you know, Peter Cullen, who does the Optimus Prime voice that just like is cool sounding, he's back and he sounds cool. But it's just there's like nothing going on in this movie. Like the other ones were about, you know, the Allspark, which was an orb they were chasing around. And this one is about it's not an orb. Like you can't say it's an orb, but it
is not an orb.
It is a glowing stick.
It is two halves of the transwarp key. I believe that's what it's called.
Yes.
So it's the same thing, but they get to look for two of them. Okay.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I just found it that there's like zero stakes, zero compelling characters. The characterizations we do get, like Anthony Ramos's character is introduced, and my buddy Jesse from the New Flesh podcast, when we talked about this, said that like they introduce his younger brother, right? And you're like, they introduce his younger brother just to be like, he has cancer or sickle cell anemia.
Sickle cell disease.
Sickle cell disease. And they introduce this thing. And Jesse was like, well, this is like, you know, a little much, but at least I expect this kid to get involved in the action in some way. He doesn't. He just is there to be like a prop and to have like some emotional weight to the backstory. And Anthony Ramos's backstory is just like, he was discharged from the military and is now maybe going to do crimes. And I just found it to be like, I just don't know why I was supposed to care about any of this. And then Fishback's character.
Yeah. Dominique Fishback
from Judas and the Black Messiah is just like completely underserved here, because the role she's given is like intern who runs the museum apparently. And like in a movie where there's giant fucking gorilla robots running around and stupid shit like that, why is the thing that strains credulity the characterization of your human character? Like, it's just like the whole thing is pitched at a degree that I just didn't buy. So I didn't buy any of the characters, and therefore their emotional arcs didn't work for me. It's hard to care about these characters we barely get introduced to. As we said, that goes for both human and robot. And I can't imagine getting anything out of this movie. I was bored out of my mind watching this. And I just rewatched the original Transformers on my quest to what I thought was going to be marathon them all. But it's kind of like they're grading. The Bay ones are like, from what I understand, the first one, at least I can say, about an hour longer than it needs to be. And I think if that hour wasn't there, I think the movie, it would go from like a 2.5 to a 3 for me. Like if it was a reasonable length, I think it is a fun. The fact that like I mean, the first one's just like a Amblin thing. It's like a Gremlins or even a Joe Dante thing. It reminded me most of Gremlins or of Small Soldiers, just like things let loose in society, but the things are robots this time. And that one has like the Amblin-y E.T. element where he's trying to hide them from his parents and shit. Like, I get that one, but I just think, you know, Bay did what he did with them. They just became like these huge, like, it's just funny that Bay ended up directing five of these things when my buddy Jesse would say he seems to hate them. He seems to hate children. He seems to not want children to watch his movies. He turned a children's toy movie into like these war allegory, not war allegories, but I mean, the first one's about Iraq and shit like that. So I just think the whole franchise is silly. And when I saw this trailer, Mark, I got to say, I was stoked. I was like, this looks fun. That, like, I think they're leaning into the silliness by having like animal robots now, but it doesn't come across as fun. It's all dour and melodramatic. And there's a lot of like stopping for emotional speeches that I don't think work at all. It just was flat for me.
Yeah, it's the same speech over and over again. When you brought up Peter Cullen, I'm like, yeah, his voice is really good. But when you think about it, like they could have easily have cut lines from any of the other movies he's done.
Yeah.
And just added that in and not have
me
him going
the
to record.
Spark or Cube or whatever. Insert thing
easily.
Here.
It's always the same dialogue over and over again. And that's what this turns into. It's just the big chase for the MacGuffin. And that's it. And some of it kind of works. I really am disappointed that Fishback, who is a very promising actor, has literally looks uncomfortable doing this because there's nothing to her character. There's nothing for her to do. Ramos is, you know, so good and In the Heights, and he's a very charming actor. And as much as he tries to put that on, you can't do that when you're just there to be in the background and talk about a bunch of exposition and then
have Pete Davidson
at the
make
end.
A bunch of jokes.
Oh yeah, we didn't even talk about.
Well, the less said about Pete Davidson here, the better, probably.
The less, I mean, his voice works for this material.
It does.
The voice, the tenor of his voice works. A lot of the humor that he adds to it doesn't fit in at all with this. There are a couple of like innuendo jokes that really are like,
I forgot about those. But like, speaking of like Michael Bay making these movies for adults, this one seems to be like, finally, they're making these for children. And then all of a sudden, you're hit with a very uncomfortable joke that I think, you know, teenagers are going to think is the funniest thing on earth because it's like edgy and kids aren't going to know what to do with it. And parents are going to be like probably pissed off if they're there with their kid and having to explain what that is. I was there with Jesse and his daughter, and he had to explain what bros before hoes meant to his daughter because that gets said at a certain point. And he said that he told her that it's a very rude way to say that boys are more important than girls to boys. You nailed that.
That's a good way to put it. Yep.
That's a good way to put it.
That's good parenting.
Rise of the Beasts is not good anything. That's a great segue. I'm right there with you. I saw your 1.5 and I match you on one.
Cool.
1.5 risen beasts.
I'm really curious though. I really like you at some point in the future. Just go to those remaining three Bay movies.
I would love to, because I've had people my whole life telling me I need to rewatch or watch. I think I also only saw the first couple of Resident Evils before I knocked out. And there's also the Paul W.S. Anderson auteurists out there who think he's brilliant. So I watched all of those, and I think I remained at like 2.5 on most of those, or maybe 3 on a couple of the good ones. But I don't know. I want nothing more than to enjoy the late Bay sequels.
You don't even need to enjoy them. I'm just out of curiosity.
Well, when read about, what is it, The Last Night? There's like the one that's like the Transformers helped Harriet Tubman on the Underground Railroad and like all these crazy history things. It does sound fun to me, but I just can see it rendered through Bay as not being fun because he's not my favorite filmmaker.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
So that's, I mean, I know how I'm going to feel about them. That's why it's hard to sit down and watch a 2-hour-and-45-minute movie, which I believe is what at least one of them is that long.
Fourth one. I think the fourth one, it's not good, but I think it might be the best.
Is that Last Night or Age of Extinction?
That's the Age of Extinction.
So that has Dinobots in it.
Yes, it does.
Why
but
weren't it
is also
they represented
2 hours and 45 minutes.
But like, if there are so the beasts are separate from the Dinobots, I'm to take.
Correct.
And
the Dinobots also don't have like reptilian skin or feathers, but the beasts have fur and feathers, which also, raises this whole
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
Well, we could get, if we start parsing the specifics, I'll lose my mind, because like Pete Davidson at one point says he can transform into like any car, a Lamborghini, a Porsche, whatever you want. And I feel like the first movie also alluded to that, but then the movies never use that really. Like they're always just what they are. And except when like an Xbox becomes a transformer or something, and it's like, okay, so anything can become a robot. It's, the rules seem very convoluted, but then they should be. This is not even based on, isn't the cartoon itself based on the fucking toy too? Like,
yeah,
it's not,
as I know. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like amazing source material that they made toys of. And you know, it is straight up, these movies are about toys. And at the end of the movie, which we won't reveal, there's a, let's say a Hasbro Cinematic Universe might be in the works. I think that's a good enough tease.
I think so.
Wow, we talked a lot about Transformers. That's fucked up. Let's move on. Yeah. I was like, we've got a lot to cover today. I thought we'd be breezing through. We spent like a cool 15, 20 on Transformers. All right, let's go right into Past Lives from A24, starring Greta Lee, is her name? I know we're from Russian Doll, but she's from a lot of other stuff too. Here is the trailer.
There's a word in Korean, Inyon. It means providence or fate.
Do you believe in that?
That's just something Koreans say to seduce someone.
What a good story this is. Childhood sweethearts who reconnect 20 years later and realize they were meant for each other. In the story, I would be the evil white American husband standing in the way of destiny.
Shut up. He was just this kid in my head for such a long time. I think I just missed him.
Did he miss you?
Got goosebumps watching that trailer. Didn't you? Did too. I can,
a little
I
bit,
can
yeah.
feel it. Yeah. It's a really great movie. Tell me about it.
So yes, it's about a girl from South Korea who emigrates to Canada and then ends up in New York City as a writer, as an aspiring playwright. She reconnects with this old friend that she had when she was in South Korea. They were both kids. They both had crushes on each other. They went on a first date together just before she leaves the country. And that's it. They just happened to both be thinking about each other, you know, he apparently for a long time. And she just kind of like happens upon like, oh, remember that kid I had a crush on, talking to her mom, finds out he's been looking for her, and they reconnect online and just do all these video calls and really kind of just fall right back into like this nice little pattern, except they're older now. They're in their 20s. They're not kids. And then after that, I don't want to say anything more, except that it does have like, I mean, the trailer gave away a little bit too much, I think.
Oh, really? I can cut it. I can cut it. So it's
different. Oh, no. Don't worry about it. Okay. It's like, I think it's, it makes
I didn't know anything about it going in either. So I just pulled over by it.
I didn't. Yeah. It's what I really, really liked about this so much is that it starts off with this opening scene in a bar, and it's like we are watching. We just have these disembodied voices saying, who are those three people
it's
sitting
the
in
audience.
The bar there?
Yes, there's an audience factor. It's interesting.
That whole people watching thing, you're just sitting there and you sometimes it happens. You're like, who are those two people? How is this other person related? And how does that figure in? And there are like the movie gets to all those answers. What I love about it is it gives you those answers over the course of this like 24 year span of time. But by the end of it, you have so many more questions. Like, what was that relationship when they were kids? What was that relationship when they were in their 20s? What can love really survive that much distance and that much time? And also an entirely different romantic relationship that seems exactly like the dialogue in the beginning, like a, you know, like just some kind of convenient thing of convenience. It's like love story convenience that actually turns out to be a lot deeper than it turns out. There are so many little details of those two coming together that it's like you feel that intense romance that you're like, yes, this could happen. But then it throws in that other element of the third character at the bar, and you realize this whole thing is not just about that.
It's the
about
whole time.
Yeah. It's balancing equal and different levels of love that you might have for somebody over all this different time and what your life is like. It's so, so, so good. I'm just going to keep.
I was blown away by it, too. I think it's like the entire Before trilogy, kind of. It's like Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight in one movie. I think it's like In the Mood for Love, which is a movie all about longing, one of the best movies of all time. It's kind of like Sliding Doors in like a what if kind of way, but it's so beautifully, specifically rendered and sad and realistically thorny that I just couldn't, you can't help but get swept up in it and just be a fucking wreck by the end of it. I think it's just about how, you know, time passes and the way someone might be in your memory, it might not translate to now, or maybe it does, or you're just in a different part of your life now. So what does that mean? And I think that the movie is brilliant because it doesn't answer any of the questions I think that it's posing. It just poses all these incredible, evocative feelings, and you're just kind of left, like, just kind of walloped by the emotions of, like, all these characters, and they're all just, like, I think it was Jason Bailey who actually cited Roger Ebert in his review by saying, Roger Ebert says, you know, the movies that make you cry hardest aren't the ones where sad things happen, but where people are good. And that is a perfect description of this movie, because you could not predict the way that this, like, quote unquote love triangle ends up, like, playing out. It is just the opposite of what you'd expect from a romance or a romantic comedy or whatever this movie is, just a drama, a realistic, thorny relationship drama. It just isn't, it doesn't have any movie platitudes to it. And I think there's also another level going on where it's a movie about people who can't fucking speak their feelings and communicate. There's like just scenes where you're like, I wrote down, like, fucking just say I love you, man. Like, your everything would change if you said the thing that both of you are thinking. Like, you know that they feel it. And it's just an amazing meditation on that idea of what it's like. I think a buddy of mine wrote this on Letterboxd. Jason Block, I'm reading your Letterboxd if you're listening to this. Haven't seen you in years. Hello. A gorgeous meditation on what it's like to stand next to someone you know, wherein the two of you both know and don't know what to say. It is just magnificent. I was blown away by it. It is stunning that it's a debut film. It is the writer director Celine Song is a playwright who lives in New York, and you can kind of feel that this is kind of autobiographical in a way. But yeah, just a deeply meditative movie and thoughtful, and leaves you feeling like good but also bad. Like, I don't think it's I don't even know if I would say it's like happy or sad at the end. It's neither. It's just life. And that's what makes it good.
It's neither and it's both. Like, because there's a here's the thing about Song. You're right. This is a debut feature. I am stunned at how much she does with such little tiny just filmmaking techniques.
Like, visual motifs and flourishes, like the fork in the road going up and down. Like, I was blown away. Just the straight up composition.
There is a single edit right near the end, like maybe 2 minutes before the movie ends, that nearly broke me. Just the edit, just the fact of,
I
like,
saw it
transporting
so
that image.
I saw it so long ago. I'm going to ask you afterwards to say what that was,
okay?
Because I'm dying to remember and cry with you again, thinking about it. Because yeah, I was definitely a puddle at the end of the movie, and I'm sure whatever scene you're talking about is the scene. There's also a line from John Magaro that, you dream in a language I can't understand. Like, I
he
just
wants to.
We're both gonna start crying. Cried on air on Roger and me. It can't be the first time.
The one scene where Magaro's character just flat out says exactly what we're thinking.
Yes.
Like that. Yeah. This love story is perfect. It is a perfect love story. And how does
and
that
I'm
character
just
the fit
fucking
into
asshole.
It?
Yeah.
And like the fact that he recognizes it. It makes him such a strong character in just that moment.
It makes
him have that awareness and that wisdom.
It makes the movie far stronger too, that he does.
Yeah.
I feel like it could have easily been accused of doing exactly what he's saying, but instead he's getting ahead of it. And I think that is how a fucking 30 something liberal white dude in New York would think, as someone who is exactly that. I love this movie. I'm going for it, Mark.
Cool.
4 out of 4.
Nice.
Past lives. Loved it.
Yeah, 3.5 out of 4. But again, very, very strong 3.5 out of 4. This is going to be hard to knock off my top 10 list, I think.
Yeah, it really does wear its influences on its sleeve, but I think it manages to tell its own story whilst doing so. You know, I feel like, and I feel like the love stories depicted in this movie, the reason it works is that it's a universal human experience. We all have had relationships with somebody that we idolize. You know, you put on a pedestal. They're a memory in the distant past. You think it was the best you'll ever have and the best you'll ever do. And I think this movie is interesting in that it evokes what that would be like if it actually did manifest, but also doesn't end the way you think it will. It's just really magnificent stuff. Very excited to see what Celine Song does next. Great movie.
Yep.
Another great movie. I saw this at a film festival in October, and I rewatched it because I loved it that much that I had to be ready for this conversation. I wanted to be fully ready. Mark liked it too. Don't worry. It's Falcon Lake.
C'est vrai qu'il y a quelqu'un qui s'est noyé ici. Ils ont trouvé corde à jeune à part Savage là, t'as vu.
Tu m'as suivi ou quoi?
Peut-être. Il y a des fantômes qui réalisent même pas qu'ils sont morts. Continue à vivre avec nous, mais ils peuvent communiquer avec personne.
Ben, sauf avec toi.
As-tu peur de te faire paniquer par le fantôme? J'y crois pas trop, donc.
Much like its placement at the Brooklyn Horror Festival, this trailer really oversells the degree to which it is a horror thing. But what it is one of the best coming-of-age movies I've seen in ages. I also love this one. I don't know if I'm going to end up giving it a 4 out of 4 like I did with Past Lives. We'll see where the conversation leads. But I thought it was... It's also a debut. And it's also a stunning, like, how the fuck is this a debut? Incredible, beautiful 16 millimeter photography, incredibly grounded child performances, like the lead is so good. Both the leads are so good. I'm just blown away by this as from the debut perspective, from the coming of age story perspective, because it feels kind of generic in that way, like what it's doing. But I feel like I haven't seen a coming of age movie that's like haunting about it. So why don't you take it from here? What is this thing?
Yeah, so it is the story of a 13-year-old kid who goes to family cabin, like a family friend cabin, I think, for summer vacation, and is going to be there. And 16-year-old girl, friend, daughter of the friend of a family, is there, and he sees her sitting in the shared bedroom that they have, sitting in the moonlight by the window, and that's pretty much the end for him, I think. So after that, he's spending the rest of the summer trying to talk to, or however long he's there, trying to talk to this girl and try to, you know, figure out what she's about and, you know, what teenage boys are thinking about. Like, I like this girl. I don't know why, but I want to spend a lot of time with her and figure out what is going on here with my feelings. And that's basically the whole story, but it has such nice, again, a movie with a bunch of nice little details. I didn't get to it, but I saw in your Letterboxd review, I like that you pointed out the scene where he rushes downstairs to get the ice cream. I don't want to steal it from you, but talk about why that's important, because it is really important to why this film works, I think.
I mean, it's the purest distillation of like his infatuation with this girl and how like she's the only thing that matters to him, I feel like. What did you get something else out of it?
That's exactly okay. It. It's like, that's great. Exactly what you do. Like, this, yeah. Do you want some ice cream?
If your girlfriend, especially when it's like, you know, new and exciting and all that stuff, like if your girlfriend is not even your girlfriend, the girl you like shows up and she's crying for whatever reason. She's sad. He's just trying to do anything he can to cheer her up. Do you want this? Do you want that? Do you want ice cream? And she goes, you know, sure. And she doesn't even say like, yes, I want it. She's like, yeah, okay. I guess I'll do that. And he fucking sprints downstairs, almost breaks his fucking neck, just like goes past everybody, doesn't even see his dad there or whatever. It's such a perfect detail for driving. It's a movie about being young and in love. It's a movie about running away from youth while still clinging to it. I'm gonna cry just talking about it. It's so good. Jesus, I am a wreck. Like literally the movie's, I think a running theme of it is we're literally running. There's a lot of scenes of people running. There's scenes where, you know, he's watching TV with the younger kids and like literally farting and like doing very childish shit. And she comes up to him and she's a 15-year-old and he's a 13-year-old, but he's gonna be, oh, she's 16, I think. And he's gonna be 14 and he, you know, 13, but I'm almost 14 or whatever. And yeah, he's like farting with the young kids. And she's like, you like hanging out with the kids? And he's like, no. And she's like, okay, come with me then. And, but like, she's out of like boredom and like that, like cool girl, 16-year-old, like this guy's younger than me, but we're both, you know, kind of like forced proximity friendship, whether like they're hanging out together for this weekend, their parents are hanging out. On a second viewing, I got a lot more about their parents than I did the first time. Just like they're kind of like fucking each other, kind of stuff going on that the kids too, which I think the movie, because you're from that perspective, you don't really pay attention to it. But it's definitely a movie about relationships and jealousy and loss of innocence and coming of age. I love that it's shot full frame 4:3 because like it reminded me of looking at like a Polaroid photograph, which this movie ends up being a lot about memory, I would say. Mark, we're not going to get into what it is, but I think you don't like the supernatural thing that occurs at the end. But I think it's baked in, I would argue. And I think it really just makes the whole text richer in a way that like I felt the same. I compare this to After Sun when I first saw it, because I feel like it's doing something very similar where like there's a big reveal that makes you see the movie differently. And I think the movie does play out like I watched it a second time looking for clues, you know, and like I think it doesn't really tip its hand. I think it does kind of play it straight. But the reveal, you know, they talk about what happens a lot. Like they talk about what's going to happen and they allude to it a lot. And I think it's interesting that what that supernatural element does, I really don't want to give anything away. I just think it makes the movie feel like you're looking back at a memory, which really makes it sing. Because I think that's what the movie's about in a way, is like that young coming of age thing.
You just gave me a little revelation here that I didn't even consider. Okay. I do wonder if your theory is accurate of I'm assuming you're thinking like in terms of the timeline of what we're watching versus the timeline of interesting.
Yeah, it really
interesting.
That's why I was really eager to watch it a second time, because I remembered the ending being what it was, and I really was like, ooh, they must have teased that throughout. And like, I think it's really
why'd you
great.
Say that?
Because now you want to rewatch it, right?
Yeah, because now I want to rewatch it. Because I'm like, maybe that is actually what's
it
going
took
on
it
here.
It took it from like on Letterboxd at least, a 4 to a 4.5. I think I'm going to be safe here and say it's a 3.5 for me, but it's so strong. It's very close to a 4. Ooh. I'm giving 2 4s in a row. Maybe I should anyway. Fuck it. 4 stars.
Yeah, do it.
There's no reason not to. I was just hedging for like, because it's too close to another one. That's bullshit.
No,
it's a 4-star movie. They're both debuts. They're both incredible for different reasons. The little details are incredible. I think the girl in particular, God, I wish I had, I'll pull up. I don't have her
Sarah
character's
Mon
name
Petite.
On.
Mon Petite.
Sarah Mon Chloe Petite.
Chloe is name.
She is fantastic. She must be like 14 or 15 or something. She's really good. But yeah, amazing coming of age story. And I do think the movie is doing more than you think, because it's very subtle and understated. And it did take me a second viewing to like
it's doing so many other things that I focus together. On. Yeah, I think
it's also very funny. We haven't even mentioned like it's
funny. It is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think. I focused so exclusively on the relationship and the dynamic. And I want to point out that even though it is from the boy's point of view, you do understand Chloe's character a lot by the end. It's not just like, you know, male gazy sort of.
Oh, no.
Boy crush
I love
thing.
The it does, way.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You just so that we part. Don't have that. Yeah. Just so we don't offer that impression of the film. You do get a really strong sense of both of these characters, even if it is from his perspective. But I focus so much on that
kinship that they have from the direct, like the director makes this clear, I would say, where it's like, as I said, he's running away from his youth and trying to hang out with her, the older kids. She's doing the same thing to him throughout the movie. She is constantly being like, oh, the cooler older kids are here. Let me go with them. it's so good. I think it's so unique and special and haunting, and I applaud the Brooklyn Horror Fest for playing it, because it is not a typical horror movie, but it was easily the best thing I saw there. All right, now let's jump to a horror movie.
I'm giving it a strong three. And now, of course, I'm going to probably rewatch it at some point and try
to see if that other element does
click, because that's my issue, is that the supernatural-ish element doesn't click with me. Compared to everything else that it's doing that's so strong. But okay, you gave me a lot of food for thought.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, I'd be interested to talk about it in more detail. So if you do that, let me know. Now let's talk about another indie horror movie. We'll do this next one, and then after we'll do with the third indie horror movie in a row, just to get it get ducks in a row. This is another one that premiered at Brooklyn Horror Festival. It didn't. This premiered at in New York last week. It didn't premiere at Brooklyn Horror Fest. It was at South by Southwest, though, I believe. It's at the Overlook Film Festival, if you're a real horror fan, and go to Colorado at the Shining Hotel, the Overlook Hotel. Here is a trailer for Brooklyn 45. It is on Shudder now, by Ted Geohagen, who I think made a really great movie called We Are Still Here. He's made a movie called Mohawk that I enjoyed. And unfortunately, I did not enjoy this one, but I don't want to be mean because I like this guy. So I will let Mark talk about it mostly. Here's Brooklyn 45.
God damn, it's good to see you guys.
DeFranco, get your ass out here.
Major?
Major.
You're all here tonight. That's very special. It's been 6 weeks since Susie checked out.
Sweetheart, we all miss Susie.
Then please, will you humor me? With a dance, spirits speak directly through us. If there are any spirits here, make yourselves known.
What the hell is that?
Don't you?
I will not reveal more. All right, Mark, talk me through Brooklyn 45.
So post-war in Europe and post-war in the Pacific, a group of people involved in the military go to this New York City brownstone, obviously in Brooklyn, in the parlor, and to do a bunch of parlor tricks involving the seance to try to bring back the dead wife of this lieutenant colonel. That's it. They're all friends. They're all in the military. The seance may or may not work. It is very much a ghost story. What I found fascinating about this is that the ghosts are, you know, literal or maybe not. But also they are more than that. There is another character in the room who may or may not be a ghost and may or may not be somebody else entirely. And the real ghosts here are just like these feelings of bigotry and prejudice and not knowing what to do with your life after you have gone through something this overwhelming and go through all these traumatic events after the fact.
Yeah.
I really appreciated the fact that it has strong characters. It has a really nice gimmick. It has some really great cinematography for just being within this single room. It looks fantastic. The actors are really good. I was very amused. Like right at the start, I was trying to figure out where Ronnie Raines came from, and I realized, oh, that's the Onion film standard guy.
Yes.
Like I knew I recognized him for something.
Yes,
he's good here. I don't know, there's so many, it's a bunch of actors that like you will have recognized from a lot of like probably independent stuff. They're all character actors.
My boy Larry Fassenden, of course. I don't want to give away anything, but I wish you were in it more is what I will say.
Okay. Jeremy Holm is in it. He plays, you know, he's an openly gay character, which is interesting for the time. You wouldn't expect it, but I like what they do with that character. There's a lot of drama going on. This is basically a chamber play. That's what it is. It's a group of characters together. And so it focuses on the characters and it focuses on the relationship and it focuses on the tension between all of them. And along with what is going on in the background and those deeper themes about prejudice and trying to figure out what to do with your life when you have reached a point where there's nothing else to do, it seems. I liked it. I'm curious what your issues are. We haven't discussed it all.
I mean, it's not that. I mean, I just hear, like, I just found it to be completely amateurish and unconvincing. Like, I didn't think the performances were good. I didn't appreciate that it basically refuses to engage with its horror setup for the middle hour, which I found that middle hour, they're talking in fucking circles about ethics and, like, just completely inorganic movie dialogue that I never bought as actual dialogue. It's so prescriptive. That's what you mean. We said, like, gay character, 1945. I'm like, yes, they existed. I'm not saying they don't. And it's totally fine for them to be in this movie. But it definitely speaks to one of my issues with it, which is just like, that's just another element that I'm like, yeah, I just think you're writing characters that, you know, are more, have a modern sensibility, because that's the movie you're writing. It has to do with modern issues that you're bringing up and trying to connect the past to the present and stuff like that. I just found it to be exhausting, honestly. Go on. Please.
But they're only modern issues because haven't been able to get past them. It was going 100%, on back then, 100%. Even after.
On paper, I love the idea of the ghosts of our past, like, affecting us today and stuff like that. But it is just, the only word I can use is exhausting. Like, I'm in the tank for this guy. Like, he is a nice man. He's a Brooklynite. He is a PR agent who gives me screeners for movies. Like, he's not just a filmmaker. So I feel really mean. That's neither here nor there. I just, like, I'm trying to say,
it's not, but
it's like, I was going in with, like, I hope to like this for all these reasons. It would be much easier for me if I like this, because I'm not a guy who lies on podcasts if I don't like something. I'm not going to review it on my horror show because I didn't like it, and I'm not mean. I don't want to pile on to a movie I didn't like if it's not a mainstream release or something. But this is my show where I review everything, so I'm not going to lie. That's how I feel about it. I watched it a long time ago, so I don't have super specifics, I guess. But, like, it just stops cold for 45 minutes of bad monologues. Are you a bad person, or do you do bad things? Does war make it okay? It's like faux profundity for me. Like, it just never, like, the philosophy gets pretty twisted throughout. If a movie doesn't convince you, like, you're fucked. It's not going to work for you. And it
convinced me. I like that it plays with the genre conventions of this, you know, ghost story, but also just telling this chamber drama about characters together and just fighting over issues of ethics and of prejudice and all this stuff. I liked it. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
It feels like a pandemic movie to me, where it's just like single location.
It might have been.
Let's get this done. I don't even know if it was. It just feels like it was born of that. No, it's fine. It doesn't matter. It's
yeah,
a
I know.
Good concept.
Having it be a
it's a good concept. The screenplay is just fucking, it felt like very first drafty to me. Like, I couldn't believe what I was watching. But there's one really, really, really inspired moment of just completely nasty practical gore that I think must have been an animatronic or something. It is so fucking gnarly. So
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, of course. Of course you do. So, you know, for that alone, I think I have to bump it up to 1.5. I didn't like this
movie. Oh my God. Okay. Oh man. Okay. Three,
I mean,
for me.
Just,
I like
it.
I mean,
it just feels like it's ripping off The Thing. It's ripping off Hateful Eight. It's ripping off Clue. If I liked it, I would have said it was doing an homage, but I didn't like it. So it's ripping off these things. I'm looking at my notes and just laughing at the lines of dialogue I wrote down. I just, if you don't find the performances, if you're not keyed into those performances or something, everything they say just makes you laugh because it's not convincing. It just felt like everyone was a cardboard cutout, and I just didn't think the horror elements really paid off except for that one. There's not much more to say. I'm sorry, Ted. I hope he doesn't find this. I just didn't like it that much. I'm definitely not going to promote in the title at all that we're talking about this. I want it to be hidden within the episode. You know what? I think you're doing
it's
me a
fine.
Favor. You're doing me it's a solid fine. By liking it, because
it's fine.
Yeah, it's totally fine. He doesn't care. He's dealt with people not liking his movies. People didn't like his movies that I liked, so that's totally fine. It's just, I really found this movie annoying. So if you're someone who watched this and also found it annoying, slide in my DMs and we can talk about it. And we'll be like, isn't it fucking annoying? Yeah, it'll be fun. You're 3 stars on it. Is that right?
I'm 3 stars. Yes.
All right. There you have it. All right. It's on Shudder now. It's on Shudder now.
Plus.
On AMC Plus. This next one, though, I think is. That's right. Yeah, AMC Plus owns Shudder. If you didn't know that, you can always get AMC Plus and you'll get Shudder with it. Whereas if you just get Shudder standalone, I feel like you don't always get AMC Plus. So you should do AMC Plus. All right, here's the trailer for The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster. I believe it's in theaters. Limited release, very limited. Yeah, hell yeah.
Death is a disease. It infected my brother, Chris. My hypothesis, there's a cure.
Your daughter has a very disturbing obsession.
What obsession?
Death. Just think about your brother. You didn't have the chance to bury him. Just wish I could catch who took his body.
Death is the disease that broke my family. I'm sick of seeing it.
Man, such an intriguing premise. Great setup. I wish the movie did better with it. It's just, I didn't like it that much. Take it away, Mark. I think you're right there with me. Yeah,
I am pretty much right there with you. It is such a good idea. It sets the Frankenstein story, in case that wasn't clear from all of the hints there. It sets the Frankenstein story in a modern day small town city. You know, there's crime, there's drug use, there's all of these afflictions happening within the community, and she is sick of it. And
for lack of a better term, it's like a hood movie, you know, like the Projects movie.
Yeah, so that like was seen in the 90s and all that. It's that idea as the backdrop. Her mother is killed in the crossfire of like a gang war. Her brother is killed under mysterious circumstances, and then she tries to resurrect the brother using a bunch of dead bodies. And the fact that she can find a bunch of dead bodies is one of those like really horrifying things that the movie, I think, doesn't quite address. Like, where is she getting these bodies from? I think the implication is there's a bunch of other people getting killed or dying in this neighborhood. Yeah. And
it's social commentary about, you know, the lot of black people being killed a lot in these communities, you know?
And then that raises the question of like, well, I mean, is the fact that nobody is really noticing this happening, that except within the community, kind of another point? There are so many ideas here, and I wish the movie had been able to flesh them out better, because there is this really, really solid idea here of having this young black girl who's incredibly smart and incredibly clever and figuring out how to literally raise the dead. Trying to address like just the ills of society by doing that. And it never comes together, because it just turns out to be just another monster movie where the monster goes amok and starts killing people. And it feels as if the movie starts to fall apart
once the monster comes to life.
Yeah, it does. Because it's really just about trying to solve the issue of the monster and what the monster is going to do versus bridging the gap of getting. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. I'm trying to interrupt less.
No, it's okay. I'm trying not to talk a little bit. So let's talk.
No, you should talk more. I'm an interrupter.
But bridging the gap between the monster movie conventions and all of the social ills going on. It's missing something. It's missing some component to make that feel as if it's a cohesive whole. And I don't know, because it's disappointing, because there is such a smart idea here.
Yeah. There's such a smart idea, especially when you think about like the idea of like black bodies as monstrous in society. Like, I feel like there's so much incredible social commentary baked in that the movie, it's so disappointing that the movie's social commentary as presented is so ham-fisted and clunky. Like, it's just also the you know, the broad like gangster characters, everyone. Did you also feel that, like, for a movie called The Angry Black Girl, why is every character besides her seeming to be the angry one? Everyone's yelling but her. It was just kind of weird. But, you know, I wish it earned its like big thesis statement that it arrives at the end, because like, I think it's saying interesting things, you know, about the idea of society creating monsters, I guess, like the idea that these people aren't people aren't inherently bad. Society corrupts them and stuff like that. The movie, the way it presents it, like the monster just goes and kills people right away. And it's like, I'm supposed to get that society did that? Like, it's just, it's so, it doesn't seem like it's thought through enough in terms of being like a movie that works as like a metaphor about society. And it's also just relentlessly bleak and unpleasant, which is tough when it's so unconvincing in those other areas. But, you know, I'll give it that there are some unsettling images mixed in there. And like, I think the monster's face is scary, but they don't really show it that much. And like, there's a scene where the girl says the ABCs in a demon voice, and it's actually kind of scary for some reason. I don't know why. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a little unconvincing in the ways that it needs to be convincing, which I guess is also what I said about Brooklyn 45. I need to change my vocabulary. but they're both unconvincing. Just like I can give two movies 4 stars, I can say two movies are unconvincing. But I want to like this movie much more than I do. It's got some cool face gore, but it's all sparing. And it's just
Also fundamentally like repetitive. Like, you brought up those gangsters. I completely forgot about that. I even just watched it like last week.
That's why it sounds like a hood movie.
On them,
like,
just keeps going. I've already forgot like, about it.
These broad gangsters that just like inhabit every movie about drugs or whatever.
Yeah, because they try to enlist her to create like drugs for them. And there's like two scenes back to back of the gangsters threatening her with that. And I'm like, how does that happen in your screenplay? How do you have the same beat to one scene right after the other and not reveal any other information within either of those scenes?
Yeah.
There's stuff like that in there.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
It's tonally inconsistent. It wants to be a movie about, black trauma, but it's just the on the nose dialogue and the fucking silly characters. It doesn't work. And also it's totally reliant on jump scares. It's just not very good. It's a, good ideas, badly executed, unfortunately. It's a 2-star affair for me.
Yep. Hey, we all agree on this one. That's
finally, that's the goal. We're trying to get singularity where Mark and I just
on the indie horror
say the same thing. Yes, that'd be great. All right. Now let's spend 45 minutes talking about this next one because there's so much to parse. This is Flamin' Hot, an Eva Longoria film.
Spicy? See, that's how I got here.
Dear God, please forgive me for the gang, the drugs, the stolen cars.
What the heck, man? Move it.
Hey, he is praying, but... Go ahead, baby.
The guy started at the berry bottom.
I know I don't look it, but I got a PhD. I'm poor, hungry, and determined, sir.
Okay, I can see you're gonna be a weird one.
What's happening?
Layoffs, son. Lots of them.
Frito-Lay isn't getting enough orders to keep the factory open.
Who eats Cool Ranch anyway?
That lady.
Ow, wow, 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 wow.
What is it?
It burns.
Will stop eating it?
No, I like it. It was good.
I had been searching for an answer. And there it was.
Let's talk about this in a two-pronged approach. Should we say what we know first or talk about the movie first? Because I think it's interesting to discuss. Would we have been as mean as we're going to be if the movie were true? If the story that the movie depicts were true? Because the problem is, this is a movie that the entire crux of it is, isn't this an inspiring true story? And reporting has since confirmed that this story is complete horseshit. The real story is a guy lied a lot repeatedly to the point where people like, that's a cool story, you should tell the press. And he did. And the press loves it because it's a great story. And then now we have a biopic about it. And the man wrote a book about it. And, now we're here. Ironically, I think a movie about that guy who is a fucking liar to the point of making a movie about himself that isn't true, that might have been interesting. Excuse me. Instead, we get Flamin' Hot as is, as if it's completely factual, with no disclaimers that it's not. And it's still a celebration of the man and the culture and whatever it is. And it's all. So what's that two-prong approach I'm looking for? Is it a good movie? Bearing all, putting that outside, is it a good movie? And then prong two is, with that knowledge, how does it fare? So take it over from here. I'm just going to spiral.
Yeah,
I'm so mad.
It is a very, very good question that raises a lot of things about whether or not fictional movies are supposed to be based in reality in any way. And how much should we discount a movie that makes up stuff even within itself, like a true story? I mean, it happens all the time in movies that are based on the lives of real people. They condense events. They put characters together. They mix real people together into a single character. They do all this stuff. Yeah. When you have the problem though, of like the story didn't happen the way that the movie presents it as happening, that's an entirely different thing. And the question is, can we blame the filmmakers? I don't think we can. I think they took it at face value that this story is what it's supposed to be, and let's make a movie about it. And my big problem with it, if we just toss aside the fact that it's not technically true to whatever degree it's not, I don't think it's a very, I'm going to use your term, I'm going to take it, it's not a very convincing movie either way. There's just a lot of stuff here that just happens and it's not believable on a foundational level. Like I don't buy that this janitor is just going to be able to call up the CEO of Frito-Lay, the Pepsi company, and get a one-on-one talk with him because the secretary finds his idea and his story inspiring. That feels very movie cliched.
Exactly, Mark.
And that's the problem.
A movie can't consist entirely of scenes that make you go, well, this is far-fetched, but I guess it must be true because based on a true story. But the story's fake. So the fact that the movie is doing all these extremely far-fetched things, once you realize it's fake, the whole house of cards comes tumbling down, in my opinion. The whole thing is just disingenuous as fuck and prescriptive and borderline offensive due to the stereotypes that they're depicting once you realize that it's not true. It's just kind of fucked up. Also, arguably weird to celebrate this as some like amazing feat, because like it's an unhealthy snack that nobody should eat, and like the whole story, the whole crux of the story being inspirational is that he was amazing because he found this market and marketed it to them. He's like, he knew that Hispanics ate spicy food, so he made them a food that they would like, that is gonna do their, you know, I don't want to get on a soapbox about unhealthy food, who cares, but the point is, that's not even the point. The point is, can't we like choose your targets better for movies? Like, do we need movies about these like guys who did like things that aren't arguably amazing achievements? Like, this movie tries to make this like a civil rights win that this man invented the hot Cheeto. It's just, it's a ridiculous movie subject as if it's this amazing civil rights thing. And all of that would be true if the movie were true, and the movie is not true. So like, I don't even know what to say. I'm just kind of blown away that they made it. And if you read the reporting, you can see that they told, like, all this stuff came out while the movie was being made pretty early on, and nothing changed. They still made the movie. The Eva Longoria has given a couple combative quotes to the press about it, saying it's whatever. I don't even want to parse why they think whatever they're saying, because it's horseshit. It also looks like a TV movie for the most part. And I read someone on Letterboxd say that the guy, the director was there or something. Or no, not Eva Longoria is the director. There was somebody there, producer. Devin Franklin was there at the screening and said they shot the movie using the procedures of a television production in order to be more efficient. I'm like, no shit. It showed.
Yeah, that happens.
Yeah. What else can you say about it?
I mean, of all of the movies that are coming out about all these like nostalgic product bait sort of things or corporate, you know, cheering on. Yes. This one is definitely the least convincing of them, for sure. Not just the least convincing in terms of like the storytelling, but also like, do I really want to feel good about this? And yeah, you're right. It is, because it's like, this is junk food. And there's a weird sequence where he enlists a bunch of drug dealers to push the Flamin' Hot Cheetos. Yeah,
that's what I mean about stereotypes.
And beyond the stereotype too, it's just like they literally say like first one's free, the rest of them you have to buy. I'm like, that's like the cliche of drug
that's
dealers.
Drug you, yeah.
You are comparing yeah. this thing that we're supposed to celebrate.
It's tone
addictive
deaf.
Narcotics.
Yeah, it's
how
tone
do you
deaf
not make
and
that
stupid.
Connection? And how do you not make that connection? And realize like it, that'd be a great satirical point. This movie yeah. treats it straight faced. It's just like, yeah, this
that's
is exactly what's gonna happen.
This could have been a
happen.
Great satire, especially with
yeah.
what we know. And it's just that's what makes me so mad is that it's a complete whiff because the material calls for it to be zany and weird. It's about a guy who lied about this stuff, but you could still tackle what this movie's trying to tackle, but it's just trying to be like inspirational, saying you can do anything, even like, you know, a low level job, like don't stop dreaming type of thing. But again, it's just so it's rendered so inaccurately and phonily that
yeah.
it's just hard to take. I really didn't like it.
What I will give it some credit that I do think it is a better movie before it becomes about the product. I think that this entire thing of him living through the 80s and this factory being closed down based on, you know, Reaganomics essentially, and the families struggling and the workers struggling and trying to keep everything going, that's a much better and much more interesting story than what it turns out to be. It's too bad that you can't focus on that and maybe, you know, the guy's actual story of going from working yeah. on a factory floor to becoming an executive within the company. That's inspirational enough, isn't it?
It is.
I think it is.
Well, I mean, it ultimately is what? Ultimately, you can use capitalism to beat racism. Like, it's just all yeah. so cynical to me, ultimately. Even though, like, it's feel-good message is still ends up being something weird. To me,
there's a lot of mixed yeah. messages in here, like especially when yeah. But then also when you could take into consideration like the economic issues and the layoffs, and then the CEO turns out to be like this really great guy. I'm like, did you forget like the entire hour of the movie before this where the company is yeah. laying off people left and right and everyone is depressed as hell about yeah. it? Apparently they did forget about that. Oh well.
Yeah, it's all that in a bag of chips. One star. Horrible.
Oh, dang. Okay. Two, very low two stars. There we go.
Wow. Very nice of you.
It is.
I feel like I have to do a public service and give every note, find everyone who gave it a positive review and just send them the article and be like, do you still feel that way? Cause it's weird. But like, I think it's worth parsing. Like, does it matter if it's true? And I think the answer is, in this case, yes, it does matter that this movie.
Yeah. In another
bullshit.
Case, if the movie were good, if the movie actually addressed some things beyond,
or if it were about just, something.
Yeah, other, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
If it were about then a larger maybe, point other mm-hmm. than just like basic like representation on screen being the whole point and shit like that. I couldn't believe how fake it all felt and prescriptive yeah. and shit. Ugh, bad.
That's
ugh. Blah. Bad movie. Let's pivot to a good movie. Let's talk about Blue Jean. Really good movie.
I need you in two teams. Jimmy, can you get over here? Mike, over there.
So, what do you mean?
I'm a teacher.
Fantastic. What do you teach?
Me? Lewis? Come on in.
You got a man on the scene at the moment, then?
No, I have no.
You do realize that the fill-over tellies with this here to distract us from what's really going on.
Not everything is political.
Of course it is.
Here at home, there's been another big demonstration against Clause 28, which seeks to stop councils from promoting homosexuality.
I've been saying this is a good idea for years. Young people have such vulnerable minds.
Can anyone tell me what fight or flight means? Fight or flight.
What's wrong? You look stressed.
I don't want students in every part of my life.
Every part of your life.
Wow. This was a powerful movie in the sense that it's depicting what? Like late 80s, early 90s Britain. And it feels perfectly at home if it were depicting, you know, current day Florida. Or any other Republican state, because it's a movie about how difficult it was to be gay in the 1980s. And I would argue it's accepted it is to be gay, period, in the world, in a society that largely shuns that or is getting better about that, but also some parts seem to be backsliding and getting worse. But it's a very specific movie about a woman, a PE teacher, who, how would you say it, Mark? She compartmentalizes her life. She is,
oh yeah,
she is, you know, a teacher at work, and then she is, you know, a gay woman at home. Like, I don't know how to describe it. I'm describing it poorly, but to say that, like, she does not let her work mix with her sexuality, but like, it's one of those, it's such an interesting, thorny way into this premise. I thought it was so smart. This movie basically presents this woman who's a gym teacher who, you know, I don't know how to talk about this appropriately, but I would say she presents as queer, maybe. Like, the movie, I think, is getting at that she doesn't ever talk about being gay or say she's gay, but I feel like, you know, some people know on site, especially other gay people. And like, this movie's about this PE teacher who is clearly homosexual and not able to talk about that at work. She has a homosexual student who joins her class. And the movie is kind of about just the thorniness of that. Not even the fact that, oh, they have a relationship and a romance. It's like, no, it's the perceived idea that if there's a gay girl in the class, that the gay teacher probably is going to want to look at her or whatever. It's just getting at all these like prejudices that we're dealing with right now in America. It's just about that. And it's like a character study about that. And I found it deeply moving and impactful and sad.
Yeah. I'm curious how much of this screenplay is being informed by what's going on today.
I wonder too, but like the stuff that
it touches,
the Margaret Thatcher speeches throughout, you know, those are all just
the billboards.
What it was back then.
Yeah, the billboard. It's like, it's almost word for word what Thatcher says, and those billboards saying, you know, keep this stuff out of our schools. It's keep it away from our kids and all that. It's like word for word what's being said in the United States and parts of the United States today. Like,
yeah,
I don't know how much of it was informed by it and how much of it is because it is strange.
I don't want to say a happy accident, a sad accident.
Yeah, a terrible accident that this movie is coming out right at this time, because it does speak to us very clearly right now, even if it didn't intend to. And I mean, that's just the horrible, sad, tragic nature of history, that there are people out there who literally learn from history and try to repeat it when it comes to this stuff. And that's horrible. Beyond that, you're right. This is a really good movie, even with taking all of that apart. It is about this woman who is trying to hide who she is from the public eye because she is worried about the backlash against her and what it would do to her career and all of this stuff. And so she has to hide exactly who she is because of the way that other people look at her and the way that society has labeled her. And how do you behave in that situation? How can you possibly behave in that situation? That whole thing about the fight or flight thing. She's in a state of constant flight. This is another debut, I believe. Georgia Oakley is the writer director.
It's Lady Debut Week, I believe.
The lead actor, Rosie McEwen. I don't know if I've seen her in anything. She's so good here. She's terrific. So good at this very internalized, very quiet performance. You can just see her always trying to figure out exactly how she needs to respond in every single situation.
And it's so hard for her. She resents herself. And it's you get it all. It's all rendered very well. Yeah,
she does a lot of things here that are not fantastic. They're not great. She but she's trying to protect herself. And if that means
I couldn't believe
somebody else in it. Yeah.
The moment that leads to like the big dramatic, I would say her turn, I guess, like that moment is so fucking harrowing to imagine, like that she would be that meek and quiet in that situation. And she would ultimately, you know, not back up the girl. Like it was so hard to watch, but like
it was.
It's a perfect scene that it's a perfect scene that illustrates the movie, what the movie's after, right?
Yeah. You understand her decisions entirely and completely. You sympathize with her, and you're also like, but still, I mean, come on. You want that to happen, but you know it can't based on the whole situation and who she is in terms of as a personality and her how she responds to the world. You're like, yeah, I get it. There's a lot of great stuff going on here. I don't know what to say about it else. I really like the cinematography. It's like, how grim it is, and you don't realize it until the sun comes out in a key scene, and you're like, oh man, this film is oppressive just in the way it looks, and that's exactly how it should look too.
You're right. Yeah. I didn't even clock that till you said it. Now I got goosebumps. It's so good. It's like, you know, there's a long history of British social issue movies, and I feel like this is a great one of those in like a more modern sense, because like we're dealing with issues that like these type of movies, even those movies probably couldn't talk about that type of stuff back in the day because of how repressive British society was towards what do they call the promotion of homosexuality and whatnot in schools and shit. Yeah, it is powerful. It is well acted, well performed, well directed. It is just incredible debut week here at the Roger Me podcast. All film female filmmakers. This one's from Georgia Oakley, and it is fantastic. I think it. She wrote and directed it. The star, as you mentioned, Rosie McEwen, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. She was also in Vesper. Remember Vesper? She wasn't the lead, but she was in it. Third lead remember. Or something. I can barely remember that movie.
Wait, now I'm trying to remember. Oh, wait, that was a science fiction thing.
Yeah, like really low budget sci-fi, yeah, but that's cool world building. I don't think you liked it that much.
I didn't. I remember that much about it.
Blue Jean, I think I'm going to go ahead and give 3.5 to keep the strong debut scores going. Got to support these young female filmmakers, Mark.
Especially when they make movies as good as these. I'm giving this a strong 3 stars. Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Definitely check this one out. If only because of how it relates to today.
I guess we should go right to, let's do Dolly Land next, because it's, I want to save the doc for last because we'll have more fun discussing it. And I don't expect this to take long. I have almost nothing to say about this movie, and I'll tell you why. Here's Dolly Land.
Are you associated with any of the art?
Yes.
Do you use anything in your hand for your job?
Yes.
Are you Salvador Dali?
Salvador Dali is right.
This is very important. You are going to the St. Regis Hotel. Salvador Dali is there. You are going to keep an eye on him. And make sure he paints.
Paul James.
Welcome to Dali Land.
Oh, man, God.
Thomas Cooper.
Jesus Christ Superstar. Who are you?
James Linton. Dala is the power. She does the deals and handles the money.
If you give us money, we give you a painting.
Whatever you do, you must not insult her.
I need a new assistant. I will borrow this boy.
Because if you do, you are out.
Dali Land. There it is. The most generic biopic imaginable. Looks a lot like the template for Almost Famous. Or not even that. Maybe that's not a good example. Oh, I guess it is. That's like the journalist interviewing the subject type of thing. But this is that's a little more sprawling than this. There's definitely a better comparison to be made. My Week with Marilyn, is that one? Like movies that are like a journalist interviewing a subject or hanging out with the subject, and that's your way into the biopic. It's definitely a sub-tier of biopic that exists. This movie made zero. The reason I'm talking in generalizations, Mark, is this movie made zero and is just exactly as I'm describing, just that generic of a biopic about Salvador Dali. But is it really about him? Tell me about it.
I don't know. Is it about him or is it about the boring kid who really likes art and then ends up being Dali's assistant? Yeah, that's the big problem, I think. Well, one of the big problems with it is that, our entryway into the movie is this guy who's works at an art gallery and then gets into Dali's inner sanctum and becomes his assistant. And he's dull as hell. There's nothing to him. He's just the innocent that's just there. He's so boring. The actor isn't very good. It's just not interesting to watch him watch all these far more interesting people who then end up being neutered, because it's about like this very specific time in Dali's life where his health is kind of diminishing, his creative output isn't as great as it used to be. And he's struggling, like, trying to figure out what this weird relationship is with his wife. That could be an interesting movie, but that's not the movie we're being told. That's not the story we're being told. That's just what's going on in the background of this kid watching all of that happen from a distance. It's weird. It doesn't work. There are a couple of flashbacks that have Ezra Miller playing a young Dali, and those just feel completely out of place because it's like there's three of those scenes. They don't give us any information. There is the scene where Dali's painting the Persistence of Memory, and you don't ever see the painting. It's just reflected by melting cheese and a superimposed clock that he hears apparently out of the ether. And like, it's so strange. I don't understand what's going on with those scenes.
It's so frustrating that Mary Harron made this, who's a really strong filmmaker who made American Psycho, one of the great movies. And you'd expect this movie to be like, you know, surreal, or like to have some sort of look that emulates what its subject is or something, right? I expected some sort of magical realism, anything to like spice up a movie about Salvador Dali. But it's just the most average, nothing fucking movie. You never get to, it doesn't feel like you experience his world in any way. It just feels very by the numbers, Wikipedia entry, biopic. It doesn't even feel like that, though.
That's the thing. Like, you don't get this.
It doesn't even register.
It's so weird. You don't get a biography. There are like those flashes of trying to give you biographical details about his, you know, being a young artist and all that. They don't register at all. There's this weird whole subplot involving potential art fraud that he was participating in, either wittingly or unwittingly, and I don't know what was going on with that and what that's supposed to say.
There's a bad Alice Cooper impersonator in there.
Yeah.
It just sucks. There's no reason to seek this movie out. It's one of those movies that I talk about fake movies all the time. It's been a while, I feel like, since we talked about a fake movie, but this is a fucking fake movie.
And it's got Ben Kingsley playing Dali. You'd think like at least that part of it would be interesting.
Gandhi, Dali, who's next for Ben Kingsley?
Think of a third option.
Tweeted us a third option for that hilarious joke. I'm not even finishing my own jokes now. I'm asking for tags. All right, that's that's one star.
I'm good with that. One and a half for me. I'm good. I'm good ending there.
Great. Really, yeah, the movie fucking sucks. All right, let's jump and talk about. We'll end on a good, but. To be clear, it's definitely a movie that feels more like a YouTube video essay than a full-blown documentary. But what does that even mean, really? We'll talk about it. Lynch Oz.
I do see the story of The Wizard of Oz as the story of David Lynch himself becoming a filmmaker.
David has gone over the rainbow from the very first film ever. He lives in a different reality than you or I do, and that's quite obvious.
Why would Lynch be that absorbed with The Wizard of Oz? Did he watch The Wizard of Oz on a perfect day, at the perfect time as a child, and it sort of baked into his subconscious?
Let's talk about what this movie is. As I said in the intro, it's more like a YouTube video essay than a documentary. It's really just movie clips from Lynch, narration, but the narration comes from very talented people like John Waters and Karen Kusama and Benson and Moorhead, the filmmakers behind such films as Something in the Dirt and The Endless, which I love, and David Lowery, the director of what's his most famous thing? A Ghost Story, Pete's Dragon, Ain't Them Bodies Saints,
Green Knight,
and fucking love the Green Knight. Yes, it's got amazing people like that talking, and the first voice you hear in the trailer is Amy Nicholson, who's a film critic and podcaster, whose voice you probably recognize if you're a listener of any of her shows. But it's just a movie for David Lynch fans examining one specific aspect of Lynch's career, which I think is what makes the movie good. Because if you start examining Lynch, you can go in a bajillion different directions because it's not even worth discussing. But this movie hones in on Wizard of Oz as like the sole inspiration for David Lynch. Like from that perspective, how does that movie inform every single one of his movies? Not just the ones that you think of. Like I told a friend about this. They go, oh, so it's about Wild at Heart, which is what most people would think of as his Wizard of Oz movie. But aha, that's just one section, or not even one section. That's just one part of the movie. It talks about Wizard of Oz's influence on every single movie he's ever made, and it's convincing. And yes, it's like very academic, and if you don't care about Lynch, I don't know if you'll care about this, but I do think it's safe to say if you are a fan of Lynch, you'll love it. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I do think maybe fans of just like art in general will get a lot out of this, because it's a really interesting exploration of like art and the artist and inspiration and motifs and auteur theory and what that is. Or it never mentions the word auteur or auteur theory. I just think it's a good example of what that looks like. A singular vision from a guy, you know? I love this. I had a great time watching it. Are you a big Lynch guy?
I'm trying to get better into Lynch, and this movie is helping me want to at least revisit a lot of stuff that I think I need to revisit. That's basically what I watched this, and I instantly am like, I need to rewatch Mulholland Drive. I need to pull out my Blu-ray of Wild at Heart. I need to do all this stuff. I need to finally finish up Twin Peaks. I have not finished up Twin Peaks, and I hate the fact I haven't finished Twin Peaks, because I've gotten halfway through season two of Twin Peaks, and season two is really bad. Up until a certain point, probably around the time where I stopped watching it. Anyway, the point is, I do admire David Lynch a lot as a surrealist artist. There are times I don't get into his movies, but I always admire them or appreciate some part of them to some degree. And what I really, really like about this movie is that you're right. It does have these six or seven different perspectives, depending. There are six different essays, video essays going into it. What I really liked about it is that they do kind of question at times, even if, can we really talk about the Wizard of Oz as the only important piece of the puzzle? Is it even a piece of the puzzle to understand Lynch? Like Lowery says that like there are a bunch of movies that he watched growing up, and he quotes them all the time. He doesn't necessarily do it consciously either. It's just those are the movies that he admired growing up, and those are the kinds of movies he wants to make now. So he has characters looking up in wonder like Spielberg does so often. Is he doing that intentionally because of E.T., or is he just doing it because that's the cinematic language I know? And so this is the big question with Lynch too, is like, is it directly inspired by The Wizard of Oz or not? And I really loved having all these different perspectives. Yeah. So many different perspectives. Some of them I think are more influential or convincing than others. I think John Waters and Karen Kusama have the best essays in here.
Yeah.
And they're told from completely different points of view too. Waters is entirely personal. It's just like this personal thing about making movies and knowing David Lynch and saying, this is what I do. And I imagine that that's what David Lynch does too. And Kusama gets into really deep detail about the whole process and the technique of doing all this stuff. It's really impressive stuff. I like a good number of her films. I wasn't expecting that level of insight from a filmmaker, because there are some of these filmmakers here who don't quite get at that level, but it's still worth listening to. I don't know. It's definitely worth watching, especially if you're a Lynch fan. If you're someone who is a Lynch skeptic, maybe this will help. This will be the breakthrough for you to at least try to understand like some level of it. I think you definitely do need to know at least some of the films and TV work of David Lynch to kind of get any sort of
grasp,
insight out of it or entertainment value out of it. But if you know of Lynch enough, it's definitely worth checking out.
Absolutely. I totally agree. This is a 3-star work for me, and definitely seek it out if you're a Lynch head. I think you'll enjoy it.
3 stars.
All right.
Yep.
3 stars from Mark, 3 stars from me. We're in synchronicity again. We did it. All right. We did it. We talked about 9 movies for the weekend of Friday, June 9th. We'll be back next week with The Flash, Ezra's Miller in The Flash. There's 2 of them or more? Mark hasn't seen it yet. I will not spoil anything. And other movies too. The Blackening, the new Wes Anderson. Will you have seen it yet? Yes, you will have.
Yeah, I'll see it. Asteroid City.
The Wes Anderson, the new Pixar film, Elemental, alongside some indies. It'll be a fun one. Thanks for listening, everybody. Please rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. There's a couple people who reached out to me personally to tell me they listen, and I appreciate that. Thank you. The only reason we do the show is because people listen. So make yourselves known. Spread the word. If you have anyone in your life who goes to the movies who would find this beneficial, please send it around. We don't have a marketing budget here. There's no ad budget. It's all you guys. So go forth. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Alien Ant Farm.
The show starts in one.
Shut up.